Yeah, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:34 PM on Thursday, April 13th, 2023. And present today, we've got Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, myself, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cologne. And just a reminder, folks could mute their cell phones, and this afternoon we'll hear House Bill 66, which is homicide resulting from a controlled substance and good time deduction. And let's see, just so folks know who's online, looks like everybody is here except for, looks like we've got a Sydney Wood, Deputy Director of Institutions Department of Commerce, and Sandy Snodgrass, CEO of Alaska Fentanyl Response Project, calling from Palmer and Anchorage. So with that, I'd like to ask Department of Law's Deputy Attorney General John Skidmore and legal intern, is it Kathy, I believe? Kathy Talmadge, to come to the table, and please put yourself on the record and begin with your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the State of Alaska Department of Law.
Katie Talmadge, legal intern for the Criminal Division of the State of Alaska Department of Law.
We're here today to talk with you all about how Alaska should be responding to the conduct in our state that resulted from killing 140, between 100 and 140 people each year, to suddenly killing over 250 Alaskans per year. That's a 73% increase in the deaths that are occurring. And those number of deaths were caused in just 1 year, and that seems to be repeating itself year after year. The conduct, of course, of which I'm referring to is overdose deaths. Overdose deaths in the state of Alaska are skyrocketing. We know that overdose deaths are increasing all across the country, but unfortunately, Alaska has the unfortunate designation of leading the nation in the percentage of increases of overdose deaths. Those deaths are being driven by two primary substances, fentanyl and methamphetamine. In a copy of the packet that you all received for this bill, you all should have also received a copy of the report that was put out by Alaska's Department of Health this past July 25th of 2022. And that's the report that really details for us this increase in overdose deaths, as well as the substances that are resulting in those increases in deaths. In 2006, the Alaska legislature passed a law creating a new subsection for manslaughter. That subsection, back in 2006, was the knowing manufacture or delivering of controlled substance in violation of our other controlled substances laws, and that as a direct result, of the ingestion of the controlled substance, that person died. What that essentially means is that if you have a person providing drugs to another person, and that second person dies as a direct result of the ingestion of that drug they've been provided, then the person who provided the drug is the one that can be held accountable. That's what's currently in our Alaska laws. That's a Class A felony for manslaughter, and it's a tool that we in the Department of Law have used, albeit infrequently, because it's a very difficult crime to prove with those elements. But it has, in fact, been proved. Since January 1st of 2018, we have charged that offense 7 times. In those 7 offenses, I'd like to provide you a couple of examples to help illustrate what we're dealing with and how this law is typically used. In 2019, there was one case in which 4 individuals were charged. We're going to refer to them as individual A, B, C, and D. Individual A sold drugs to individual B. Individual B sold drugs to C and D. C and D then decided to use those drugs with a third person, or a fifth person in this case, and that fifth person died as a direct result of the ingestion of those drugs. All four, A, B, C, and D, were charged with the offense of manslaughter. What happened thereafter is that in C and D, the individuals who shared it with the friend, those individuals entered into plea negotiations with the state, agreed to testify against B, the person who had sold them the drugs, and they were ultimately convicted of misconduct involving controlled substance in the second degree and received sentences of 4 years with 1.5 to serve and 2.5 years suspended and placed on probation for 3 years. Their cooperation, the agreement to testify against the person who had sold them the drugs, enabled us to then prosecute person B. Person B would not agree to cooperate and testify against person A. But person B was ultimately convicted. Person B was convicted of manslaughter, the count that was available in current law, and was sentenced to 7 years with 3.5 suspended and 3.5 years to serve and was placed on probation for 5 years. Person A, the highest level, who started the process of distributing, we were not able to prosecute and we had to dismiss that charge because we could not prosecute that individual without the testimony from person B. There was no sufficient admissible evidence in order to convict person A. That's the way that this works. And so in this bill, what we are proposing to do is to take that manslaughter and instead of have it as a manslaughter, to move the classification to murder in the second degree. And what that effectively does is it provides us the ability to impose harsher penalties against the person who is ultimately convicted for having caused the death. Let me talk to you about a fifth incident that we charged, however, to also help illustrate the types of cases in which this particular subsection is used. This incident also occurred in 2019 and was unrelated to the previous case that I mentioned a moment ago. In this other case, an individual provided drugs to another person that ultimately killed that second person. The defendant, the person who had provided the drugs, remained with the person who died until the time that paramedics arrived. However, that individual had had several opportunities to call for help earlier and failed to do so. Instead of calling the authorities, the individual decided to opt for risky and what I'll refer to as some distasteful choices in terms of how they interacted with the person that was overdosing in their presence. First, that individual decided they would smoke some methamphetamine and then blow the methamphetamine smoke into their friend's mouth, trying to get it into their lungs to try to reverse the overdose that was occurring from the other drugs that had been provided. That was the first thing they attempted. The second thing they attempted is they transported this victim to a second location, stripped all of their clothes off of them, and placed them into a bathtub filled with ice and water in the hopes that that ice and water would somehow reverse the overdose that was occurring and killing their friend. That also did not work. But that wasn't the last thing that this person decided to try. They then took a butter knife, placed it in the freezer. Having frozen the butter knife, they decided to insert the butter knife into the anus of their friend in the hopes that that would reverse the overdose death. That likewise did not reverse the overdose. In addition to taking those steps, the defendant in this case also took the victim's car and wallet to the individuals that had sold them the drugs and provided them to these drug dealers as opposed to the authorities. And this was done to help hamper the state's ability to go after the other individuals that had distributed the drugs. This individual refused to cooperate in trying to get any of the other individuals that had sold the drugs and then themselves was ultimately convicted of manslaughter. They had a sentence of 9 years with 6 to serve, 3 suspended, and 3 years of probation. This is illustrative of the types of cases in which this particular charge is used, of the type of conduct that comes to us for enforcement. In both of those instances, I would submit to you all that the individuals that caused the deaths in each situation were probably individuals deserving of punishment far greater than what they actually received. This bill would allow courts to have greater discretion in the sentences that they would impose in terms of the range that would be imposed in those situations. Fentanyl, as I indicated, is not the only drug driving the increase in overdose deaths. Methamphetamine is also doing that. But the fentanyl increases in overdoses between 2017 and 2021, 417% increase in the number of overdose deaths attributed to fentanyl. If you go to the report itself, it will tell you that the vast majority of the deaths are not occurring from a single drug, but rather from a combination of drugs, sometimes two, sometimes three. Being able to attack all of those drugs when the overdoses occur is an important factor in this. The bill has three other provisions as well that I want to make sure I mention to you. The other provisions, or the steps that the administration is proposing through the bill, is to also look at good time. Good time is the concept when somebody is incarcerated after having been convicted and they're eligible for parole. There are two types of parole. There is discretionary parole and there's mandatory parole. Discretionary parole, the example I use with many of you and I tell others, is think of Shawshank Redemption. In Shawshank Redemption, you have the inmate, that's Morgan Freeman's character, who goes in front of the parole board repeatedly requesting permission to be released from jail on parole. That's discretionary parole. That's not where good time is impacted. Good time is related to what's called mandatory parole. Mandatory parole is not where an individual is asking to be released. Mandatory parole is just that. It's mandatory. The person is automatically released from jail when still a portion of the sentence needs to be served. This is done to put them back into the community to attempt to begin the rehabilitation efforts while the person's in the community. They're supervised by a probation or a parole officer. Mandatory parole is related to good time because your eligibility for mandatory parole is based upon your behavior while you are in custody. If you do not behave, you are bad, you have your good time reduced, and therefore reduce the mandatory parole. In our statutes, because it is a creature of statutory construction, there are other crimes that the legislature has already elected should not be eligible for any mandatory parole. These are individuals that will not be let out simply because they behaved while they are in custody. What the bill proposes to do is to add the distribution or the dealing of drugs to those other types of crimes in which mandatory parole is restricted. So that's the second provision. The third provision that I want to mention, and these are provisions that were added in the previous committee. The first provision deals with when in drug distributions, you typically have both a supply side and a demand side, right? You have the individual supplying the drugs and you have the person seeking the drugs. But this third provision is addressing those circumstances in which the person is not seeking drugs. They're not asking for drugs. They're not trying to go and buy drugs from somebody else. They are the true innocent individual who never sought the drugs, but nevertheless has somebody else deliver those drugs to them, administer the drugs to them. Let me give you some examples to help illustrate the point. If I'm at the bar and I'm sitting there and I have my drink and I have my glass sitting here and I turn my head and I'm looking someplace else and somebody puts a controlled substance in my drink and then I then take that glass and I consume it, I've now had controlled substances delivered to me, though I wasn't seeking them out in any way, shape, or form. The question that you have to ask is whether or not the drug dealer who is supplying drugs to someone that's seeking them, please give those to me, I'm going to give you money for them, should be treated the same as the individual who's providing drugs or giving drugs to somebody who was never seeking them to begin with and without their knowledge. What this provision of the bill does is it takes the concept of whether somebody is mentally incapable, incapacitated, or unaware that a drug was being provided to them. These are concepts found in Alaska's sexual assault statutes right now. And the definitions that apply there equally apply here. If you have a victim who is in one of those three states, mentally incapable, incapacitated, or unaware, and has drugs provided to them, administered to them, then that would make the distribution of them, the providing of them, at a higher level of offense. It's already illegal to distribute the drugs. But if you're now giving them to somebody that wasn't seeking them to begin with, that elevates it to an unclassified felony, which makes it a 5 to 99 year sentence. The fourth provision that's in the bill deals with what's called special circumstances. In Alaska law, you have various levels of felonies, an unclassified, a Class A, a Class B, and a Class C. For the Class A felonies, they have a presumptive sentence for a first-time offense of 4 to 7 years, with a maximum of 20. Special circumstances are when there is an additional factor for that Class A felony that makes it a special circumstance and therefore elevates that first time presumptive sentence. When special circumstances are established, the penalty goes from 4 to 7 to 7 to 11 for that presumptive sentence. And what the bill proposes is to add the distribution of Schedule 1 drugs as a special circumstance. That would mean people that are distributing things such as methamphetamine, heroin, something along those lines, those opiates. If they are delivering those, then that becomes a special circumstance and elevates the penalty from a 4 to 7 to a 7 to 11. And to help you understand that, the last thing that I want to make sure I point out for you all is you all should have each received in your packets either one page or two page, depending upon how you all printed it. It's a one page if you're looking at both sides. It's two pages if you just have two single-sided. The first one, it says Controlled Substance Statutes Reference Chart. And this is a chart that provides the 5 different degrees of misconduct involving controlled substances, 1st through 5th. And it tells you what the class of the offense is, the penalties that are associated with it for a maximum, and a first-time presumptive range. Then on the far right-hand side of it, it gives you a sense of what is the conduct that's criminalized by those statutes. This is not meant to be an exhaustive restatement of the law. And if there are any questions about the law, I obviously encourage you to go back to the statutes instead. This is meant to be sort of a cheat sheet, some guidance to help you understand general concepts. It is not a complete listing of all the subsections. The second page provides you the schedules. And the importance of the schedules is these are the drugs that the state of Alaska has said are illegal to provide to other people unless you have an appropriate license. And the schedules are listed 1 through 6, and you have, again, samples of the types of drugs that are found within the schedules. This is not a complete listing of them. It's not meant to be a complete listing of them. If you go to our statute books, you will find that the schedules themselves are many, many pages long with long, complex names that I can't pronounce. So what you have instead is a reference to give you a sense of the type of drugs that we're talking about so that we hope that's of aid to you all as you're evaluating the bill and some of the policy calls that have to be made here. Those are in some of my comments. We have Ms. Talmadge to do sectional, and then there was also invited testimony, but Chair, I'll leave it to you as to how you'd like to proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Skidmore. Before we get into questions, I would like to finish off the presentation with the sectional. And also going to Ms. Snodgrass online. I know that there's probably going to be a lot of questions. I'm afraid that if we start getting questions now, we're going to go down a lot of rabbit holes and we're going to miss the big picture. And I'd like to maybe get the presentation out of the way first. I'd also like to mention that Representative Edgman joined us earlier. So with that, Ms. Talmadge, if you could proceed with sectional.
Katie Talmadge for the record. HB 66 has 8 sections. Section 1, as previewed by Mr. Skidmore, is the murder provision. Here it is murder. It would be murder in the second degree if an individual manufactures or delivers a controlled substance and a person dies as the direct result of ingesting that controlled substance. Section 2 is the misconduct involving a controlled substance in the first degree provision. It adds a new subsection that would be misconduct in the first degree where someone delivers any amount of a Schedule 1A, 2A, 3A, or 4A controlled substance to a person who is mentally incapable, incapacitated, or unaware that a controlled substance is being delivered. Section 3 contains the definitions for incapacitated and mentally incapable. Section 4 is the special circumstances sentencing provision. Here, it would provide an enhanced sentence for A, felony convictions for manufacturing or delivering a Schedule 1A controlled substance. The presumptive range for a first-time conviction would be 7 to 11 years. Section 5 is the good time provision. It precludes good time deductions for felony drug dealing convictions. Section 6 is the repealer section. It repeals the provision of manslaughter that is being moved to murder in the second degree by Section 1. Section 7 is the applicability section. This bill is applied prospectively. And Section 8 is the effective date. This would be effective July 1st, 2023.
Great. Thank you very much. And in keeping with trying to stick with the big picture for now, maybe if we could move over to the invited testimony, and then we'll go to questions. So with that, Ms. Sandy Snodgrass, if you're online, can you put yourself on the record and go ahead and proceed with your invited testimony?
Yes. Hi, my name is Sandy Snodgrass. I'm the CEO of AK Sentinel Response Project. I'd like to thank the committee today for accepting my testimony in support of House Bill 66. My son, Robert Bruce Snodgrass, was poisoned to death on October 26, 2021. He was 22 years old. He was my only child. Since that time, I've been advocating for fentanyl awareness, prevention, education, and investigation and conviction in cases surrounding particularly fentanyl. My son received 100% fentanyl the day he died. He dropped where he stood, 40 feet away from a Wells Fargo drive-thru and a McDonald's drive-thru in Anchorage, Alaska, and was not able to call out for help. Dropped and died where he stood. So I believe that rather than being classified as an accidental overdose, what happened to my son was a poisoning. It should be considered a drug-induced homicide, and the distributors and manufacturers of fentanyl should be held to the highest level of punishment, which is what this bill will do, and they should have been charged with second-degree murder. Whoever's bringing these drugs into the state of Alaska needs to recognize that our leaders are going to stand up to the fentanyl crisis in this state and provide the highest level of punishment. I believe that'll enable prosecutors to negotiate with lower-level drug dealers to turn on their higher level drug trafficking organizations. In the example that Mr. Skidmore gave, had that person been charged with second degree murder, they would have been more likely to turn over person A. That's my belief. So unfortunately today, I want to talk for a few minutes about what's happening in Alaska in the last 2 weeks. So some of you may be aware of what's happening in Alaska in the last 2 weeks. There have been what I call and what people in the fentanyl community call a mass poisoning event in the valley, in Palmer and Wasilla. 5 people are known to have died in the last 2 weeks in the valley. 20 more have presented to emergency rooms and have been successfully reversed with naloxone. That's 1 year from a date last year in March where 9 people died in the valley and over 25 were successfully reversed in a 1 week period last year. In Anchorage, in the last 2 weeks, there have been 8 high school students successfully reversed in high school from fentanyl poisoning. 5 of them were young girls, 9th grade girls at Bartlett. Luckily, they returned to campus after lunch and told the nurse that they weren't feeling well, and they were successfully reversed. 3 more at East High School, males, have been successfully reversed in East High School in the last 2 weeks. We've had, as you probably know, you're in Juneau, 3,000 pills interdicted in Juneau. Recently, there have been 2,000 pills interdicted on a flight headed to Togiak, Alaska. Togiak, Alaska is a rural community. Had those drugs been able to infiltrate Togiak, Alaska, it's just unimaginable what could have occurred there. So we know that drug trafficking organizations are targeting Alaska because of the prices that they can charge for their drugs here. They can charge $10 for a pill in Los Angeles, California, or Seattle, Washington. They can charge $80 for that same pill in Togiak, Alaska. They are targeting Alaska, and they know they will not be prosecuted for second-degree murder. They would only be prosecuted for manslaughter, and they're willing to take that risk that they will not be prosecuted in this state. I urge this committee to pass this bill as quickly and expeditiously as possible, to get this bill into law by July of 2023. Unfortunately, none of the five people that died in the valley in the last 2 weeks, their families are not going to receive the proper justice of the second degree conviction in their loved one's death. We need to move quickly. This is one leg of the stool that you can help prevent further death in the state of Alaska. We need the highest penalties that are available to deter drug traffickers from targeting our state. I appreciate your time today, and I'd like to stay on if anyone has any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gress. So we'll go to questions, and I just first wanted to start, I think, on some of the more complicated things that come before us. I try to break it down to something that the public can understand in the most simplest form. And would it be fair to say that essentially what this bill does is it increases criminal consequences to folks who deal drugs? Would that be a fair statement? I think if you're just talking to somebody for 30 seconds on the street and they want to know what this bill does, would that be a fair statement?
To the chair, yes.
Great, thank you. So with that, I think we're going to have a number of questions on this. And first, we've got Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, is it Representative Colomb, Representative Ortiz, and Representative Galvin and Stapp. Try to remember what that order was. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you, Mr. Skidmore. Through the chair, my first question is about the good time issue.
Mm-hmm.
So am I right that, for just as one example, if someone were to shoot a firearm at another person and miss the target, and we would call that either an attempted murder or an assault, maybe an assault in the third degree, something like that, that person, the shooter in this instance, was fortunate to not hit the target.
Mm-hmm.
They may have felt otherwise at the moment, but they would get good time for basically, it's almost like an inchoate, I think the word is, offense. They tried for a higher offense, they failed. At any rate, even for a bad crime like that, they would get good time. But in this bill, as it stands now, the person who delivered a drug and no one died would not get good time. So the reason I ask is that I see an analogy there in terms of potential harm. In both instances, there could be a death. In neither instance, there was a death. But under the bill, we would treat the drug dealer more harshly than the shooter. Is that right?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, the section of the bill that you're asking me about, dealing with the good time, I want to make sure I refer to the right section in the new version. This would be Section 5. And Section 5 lists out the statute where the restrictions for good time are located. And so if you were to actually look on page 5, so this is Section 5, lines 1 through 7, you will find those crimes that are already have restrictions for good time. And they are things like murder, sex offenses. And so the conduct that you described to me, I would agree, by and large, would not have good time restricted. If you get to an attempted murder, there is the possibility in that scenario, so I want to be cautious with that. But otherwise, you are correct that the vast majority of crimes in the state are subject to good time. And what this bill would do is that it would add all levels of drug distribution, well, more carefully, drug distributions in 1171, 110 through 040, so I shouldn't say all levels, but those levels of drug distribution would be added to the restrictions for good time.
Does, as a policy matter for the state, doesn't that have the impact of saying we were less concerned? I mean, you may decide you don't like the words less concerned, but as a reality, in the statutes, we would be less concerned with the shooting and missing than the delivery and not killing the drug recipient. because we're saying we'll give good time to the former and not the latter.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is a policy call that's being made of how seriously will the distribution of drugs be treated. I think your characterization is a fair one to be made. The question remains, what's the policy call that the legislature would want to make?
Follow up? Am I right, and I think this is very important for the committee to hear, that it was not the administration's goal, but rather it was the Judiciary Committee's goal to have this special circumstance where, for example, if I had an opiate prescribed to me lawfully for back pain, for example, and I was camping with a friend far removed from the rest of the world, and my friend said, I'm in agony, I have back pain. I give my friend a pill. Your intent, other than on the good time part, and that's important, but your intent was, that is the administration's intent, was not to increase the presumptive penalty for my bad behavior while I was camping with my friend by distributing that pill. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the way that the bill was originally introduced, it had the provision for changing manslaughter to murder, and it had the provision on good time. You were correct that it did not have the provision creating the special circumstance for the distribution of Schedule I drugs. That was added in House Judiciary.
Follow? So right now, going back to the camping episode, that bad behavior, which is prohibited now, would result, if there was no significant prior history, at likely no more than 4 years. Remember, the pill here I'm talking about is an oxycodone. And the defendant would get good time of a third, so they might do, for distributing a pill that, mind you, might actually have the impact of helping the person's back, albeit it's illegal. So that would be, with good time, about 2 2/3 time to serve. But under this bill, that same behavior would jump to 7 years. Is that roughly accurate?
Through the chair, to Representative Josephson, as you describe the penalties that can be imposed under the statutes, that part is accurate. The part that I would probably take issue with is the presumption that the person who provides the pill to their friend ends up with a conviction and therefore a sentence under that same subsection. That's the part where I would candidly tell people there is a thing called prosecutorial discretion. Does the law make it illegal for one person to provide that drug to another? Yes, it does. And there are a number of policy reasons that it probably does that. Anything from the average person doesn't have the training and medical knowledge to know whether or not the drug they're about to supply to somebody else might have an adverse impact or reaction for other drugs that that person is taking. You don't know what other medical conditions the person may have that that particular drug would have negative consequences for. So I think there are reasons that our law is structured to say that one citizen should not be providing drugs to another citizen in that circumstance. Having said all of that, I don't disagree that it is illegal and someone could be convicted for that behavior. I just find it unlikely that that's the way prosecutorial discretion would be exercised in those circumstances. But otherwise, legally, yes, your statements are otherwise accurate.
Last follow-up?
Representative Josephson.
So, through the chair, Mr. Skidmore, I guess what I'm sort of wondering about is to what extent, even though the citizens of the state should take comfort in that prosecutorial discretion wouldn't be too aggressively exercised, that whether the citizens are civil libertarians or just libertarians, or they're defense bar advocates, or they're just people who want to be left alone, that they should have in the code, in the blue book, some comfort of knowing, you know, when there's a prosecutor who exercises worse discretion than John Skidmore, it's going to be okay because the code protects me. Do you have any thoughts about that at all?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the provision that was added that is addressing the special circumstances was an attempt to look at what's driving the overdose deaths and the significant increase in the problems within the state, particularly with fentanyl. If you look at fentanyl and the number of deaths that have occurred because of fentanyl, if you look at fentanyl being mixed in with lots of other drugs and you're trying to target that particular type of behavior, then one of the policy calls that's made to do that is to try and associate greater penalties with the fentanyl. And that's what this is attempting to achieve. The question that I think is before you all is whether or not you think that that effort to target that behavior is appropriate, and I think you are trying to present the counterpoint of why people may not want to do that. Ultimately, where the majority of folks land, I leave to your all sound discretion, but I believe that's the way the debate's set up. Thank you.
Okay, in the queue, and please let me know if I've forgotten anybody here, I've got Representative Hannon, Representative Colomb, Representative Ortiz, Representative Galvin, Representative Staff. Did I miss anyone? Hearing none, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. Skidmore, your closing statement leads right into my question and your last statement to Rep. Josephson. So Alaska leads in this increase in overdose deaths.
Yes, ma'am.
Do we know the state that has the lowest increase in that?
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm looking to understand their drug penalties in relation to ours. Are they a state that has the highest penalties for fentanyl-related crimes?
Give me just one moment. The document that I look at to provide you that information comes from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. It is, they use the I think it's an acronym, SUDORS, S-U-D-O-R-S. This particular report was published on December 8th of 2022. And in this particular report, it on page 2 indicates the rate of overdose deaths by state and the drug overdose class. The lowest state was Nebraska at a 9.4. The overall average was 34.3, and Alaska was at a 37.9, so above the overall national average. DC and West Virginia had the worst. You asked me about Nebraska's laws, if you'll give me just a moment. Nebraska is one of the states that does have a drug homicide provision, much like what we're talking about here. So they do have that particular provision. Can I tell you that that provision is expressly linked to that rate? I cannot make that comparison, but your question for me was who has the lowest. That's who has the lowest according to the CDC.
Hello?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Foster. Because no one here is pro-fentanyl, right? Everyone is opposed to drug overdose deaths, especially in the criminal element. I guess I'm sure that surgeons and appropriate use of fentanyl is not something that we have problems with, but it's when it's used inappropriately. I am concerned that our approach to solving the problem of fentanyl deaths is after the deaths occur, because nothing in this stops the death unless, and you're kind of alluded to it, it has prevented a fentanyl distribution from happening. So you gave us two examples of crimes that have been prosecuted by the state that you the second scenario you gave us, the guy who smoked meth into the lungs of his overdosing friend, ice bath, butter knife, which implies to me pretty irrational thinking and conclusions. Mm-hmm. And it is very hard for me to grasp that person's behavior would change in relation to the probability of a punishment change. But so I'm trying to see that correlation of he wouldn't have done this pretty heinous and horrific, bizarre, twisted behavior if he had known he'd get 10 years and a murder conviction versus manslaughter. But I'm not sure if the example was to illustrate something else, but, you know, the death had still occurred. So I'm just not sure that the examples you're giving us have solved anything with resulting, it has directed any reduction in our fentanyl overdoses, but it certainly does increase the punishment for people who are distributing fentanyl. But you see a connection between those, that if we increase the punishments, we'll reduce our overdose?
I do. Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I see that connection in a couple of ways. First, by increasing the penalties, you are creating a general deterrence to others that are bringing the drugs in the state because they now see greater potential penalties that they would be facing. Second, in that example that I gave you, you have an individual that engaged in extremely outrageous behavior. Whether or not they would have changed that behavior at the time, I don't know. But that individual didn't feel that a manslaughter conviction with the sentence that they received was enough incentive for them to say, you know what, I would rather have more of my life back and give you the individuals that sold the drugs, that were rationally thinking, that are looking to simply profit off deaths in state. They didn't see that as an option that made sense to them. But if you increase the potential penalties, then that's more likely. That does allow us to go after the people that are distributing it. And when you take out the people that are distributing it, you prevent the drugs from coming in the state, then I think you can decrease overdose deaths. That's the connection that I make.
Thank you.
Representative Stapp, did you have a question on this point?
Yeah, I'll just wait my turn, though.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Colon.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Skidmore, can you tell me what the purpose of good time is?
Through the chair, the purpose of good time, as I understand it, and I'm not the expert in the area, there are folks from DOC that potentially could answer that. But the way that I view the purpose of good time is that it is a way, one of the methods that Department of Corrections can use to incentivize good behavior while somebody's in custody.
Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So if it's an incentive for good behavior and, you know, I guess under the best circumstances that they're actually getting help when they're incarcerated. So if we pull that away, what I'm trying to figure out by pulling good time away, how does that help anything other than make people feel better that they're staying in jail longer? And my context is we know the recidivism rate is the highest in the nation. So now we're releasing people. They have no incentive for good behavior. And you're releasing them out, and they're going to be out in the community eventually, whether it's 4 to 7, 7 to 11, or whatever. I guess I'm just trying to figure out how good time actually helps this situation other than, I guess, you keep them off the streets a couple more years. But they're going to come out into the community eventually, which I think a lot of people misunderstand, that if you extend all these sentences, yes, they will be behind bars for a little longer, but eventually they will be out. And I'm definitely alarmed by the fentanyl crisis. I want it addressed for sure. So it's not that I'm, you know, I take this lightly, but I want to make sure that if we pass a bill that's something that's actually addressing the issue that will actually change what's going on. And so if you had any comment about the good time thing.
Through the chair, I think you're asking an excellent question in terms of what do you do? How do you incentivize good behavior? I 100% agree with your premise. People are going to be getting out of jail. However, you are also correct that what restricting good time does is it keeps them off the street for some period of time longer. That's one of the sentencing goals that's found within our Constitution and our statutes. It is something that can appropriately be done. It does limit that person's being back out in the community for how long they're going to be there. It decreases that by a little bit. But again, they will get back out regardless. Mandatory parole does not restrict discretionary parole. It does not restrict probation. So there are other ways that someone would be supervised when they come back out. But this particular provision about good time, I submit to you, is a difficult policy determination that has to be made. And as I've indicated to you and almost everybody else that I've met with, this is a provision that the administration is very much open to a conversation about what do people think is the right policy call to be made in that area. There are other ways that can be approached. You could restrict good time, for example, if you wanted to target fentanyl. to say this is only going to be for Schedule I drugs, that it would be restricted. If you wanted to say we're not so focused on the type of drug, but instead we want to focus on those people that repeatedly engage in this behavior, you could say we're going to restrict good time for those individuals that are repeat offenders. There are different ways to approach that, and what's the right policy call is certainly something that I think you all are capable of discussing with one another and coming up with what you think is the right approach to that.
Great, thanks. Can I have one more question?
Representative
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, my other question is, when the governor first put this out, I thought this was a fentanyl bill, but I don't see the word fentanyl in here. It seems maybe through the Judiciary Committee that it's been broadened to a lot of, and you spoke a little bit about that, trying to get to a bigger problem, but I'm not sure, I guess, I'm sorry, you went pretty fast. I'm not sure where fentanyl fits in sure. What class. And do you have any comments on why fentanyl specifically isn't mentioned or addressed in this bill?
Those are excellent questions, and I appreciate the question. Through the chair, the bill is and always has been focused on fentanyl, but not fentanyl exclusively. Fentanyl is a Schedule I controlled substance in the state of Alaska. And so anytime you talk about Schedule I, so when we talked about those special circumstances, that's targeting fentanyl. When you talk about increasing the manslaughter to murder, because it includes Schedule I, fentanyl is also included within that. Each of the provisions that's within the bill, because it touches on a Schedule I, then it does, in fact, involve fentanyl. Why call it Schedule I as opposed to simply fentanyl? And the answer to that is, while we see fentanyl creating problems for us right now, there are other, I don't want to call it types of fentanyl because that's probably not the right way to describe it, but there's things like carfentanil, which is another drug that's even more powerful than fentanyl, and there are other derivatives. Fentanyl is a synthetic drug, so it's something that you cook up in the lab. And you can change that formula slightly, and if you target it to formula A, and they change a zero or an A or a B or whatever the formula looks like, because I'm not the scientist. However you change that formula and you create a slightly different drug, but the bill, you all were to only target fentanyl, it now wouldn't cover that new change. And so that was a challenge that the state faced back when we were dealing with bath salts. There was these new chemicals that were coming forth, and we would try and criminalize them. And by the time we had them criminalized, the folks that were creating them just changed the formula enough so that whatever statute had just been passed didn't address it. That's why we talk about Schedule I overall or Schedule II overall. So it does focus on those things. And I believe that the governor's press conferences talked about fentanyl because fentanyl is what was grabbing most of the attention in the headlines. But again, I refer people back to the report. And you will note, I think it's on page 4, if I'm not mistaken, there's a graph that shows the increase in overdose deaths. And the top line is for those synthetic opioids that fentanyl is part of. But the second line below it, which I believe is blue, is the one that deals with drugs that include methamphetamine. And you'll note that it's right there in a close second. If you read the text of the report, it tells you that methamphetamine is equally causing increases in deaths just by a little bit less, but also needs to be targeted. And methamphetamine, for your reference, is a Schedule II instead of a Schedule I. So is the bill simply about fentanyl? No. But does it target fentanyl? Absolutely. It just looks at the whole picture of everything that's going on with overdose deaths.
Okay. And one more follow-up.
Oh.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So my concern with that, when you just say Schedule I,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of drugs listed under that.
Yes, ma'am.
I mean, we just really broaden the scope. And so if we're, quote unquote, throwing the book at them, I'm concerned by broadening that much. If we're trying to deal with overdose deaths, I would like to see us kind of target those situations. We're not going to get every single situation, but obviously we've seen an increase since fentanyl has entered our community. So that was why I was asking about it, because there's a long list of drugs under that class A or wherever fentanyl lands.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm skeptical that if we do that, that there might, I'm concerned, I should say, about this unintended consequences of situations that, you know, what Representative Joseph had alluded to. So that's all I had. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Rep. Colombe and Rep. Josephson asked some questions around good time, which I had in mind as well. But one more question in relationship to good time, and it's around when good time is applied. Mm-hmm. Is that like an objective determination rather than, like, so say, for example, there's just been no reports of, quote, behavior that violates the rules, so automatically good time applies? Or is there some sort of subjective determination as to whether or not this particular person has served in good time?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, in managing good time, that's something that time accountants within the Department of Corrections generally deal with. And I could take a stab at that, but that would seem a waste when we have Sidney Wood, who's on the phone, who is with the Department of Corrections and is the chief time accountant, and I think can give you a more detailed answer than I could ever hope to.
Okay.
Did you say a Ms. Williams?
Sidney. It's a Mr.
Oh, Sidney Williams. I don't see a Sidney. Mr. Williams, are you online?
Not Williams, Wood.
Oh, Woods. Thank you.
Sorry.
Yes.
You can put yourself on the record, Mr. Sidney Wood.
For the record, my name is Sidney Wood. I am the Deputy Director of Institutions for DOC. And through the chair, to answer the question, good time is applied. It's not subjective. It is applied when a prisoner is sentenced, and based on the statute, we apply it if the sentence earns good time, and it happens right at the beginning. Throughout their incarceration, they can lose that good time if they commit a disciplinary infraction, and then they have an opportunity to earn that back as well.
Okay, thank you for that. That helps clarify things. Another question I have, if I can continue on. Under the original statute, where the crimes that we're talking about fall under the category of manslaughter, correct? Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
And if we were to adopt this, it would move it up to second degree murder, correct?
Yes.
Under the original, how many convictions were achieved by the state in the last 10 years in relationship to the crime being manslaughter?
Through the chair, the statute itself was enacted in 2006. I apologize, I don't have statistics for the past 10 years. I can tell you in the last five. And in the last 5 years, I had told you that we had charged that particular offense 7 times. There was the 2 convictions that I talked about, the 1 dismissal and the 2 other folks that had their charges pled down. The 2 remaining out of that 7 still have their charges pending, so I can't comment on those cases any further at this time. So 2 in the last 5 years is the simple answer.
And I'm asking this in relationship to, if we were to move down to this, or make this change, mm-hmm. can you show me any evidence that would really bring about an impact in relationship to, for example, if we only achieved 2 convictions in the last 5 years, mm-hmm. By simply changing this to a second degree murder, is there any evidence that we would actually start to ramp up the convictions in order, you know, see what I'm saying?
I do.
Would it have an impact?
Sure. And I through the chair, I appreciate the question. The administration's never taken the position that this is going to increase the number of convictions, because there are always proof issues with those types of cases. What it does do is it increases the penalties, which, one, isolates the individuals that are engaged in that behavior for a longer period of time. 2, would hopefully give us better or greater tools to try and reach higher on the food chain, if you will, in that drug distribution network. The greater penalty that somebody faces, the more likely that they are to say, I want to do something to help myself, and I want to give you someone that's higher up. The higher up the food chain you go, the greater you disrupt the supply, the greater the impact it can be. Can I tell you precisely what that's going to turn into? I can't, but that's the logical analysis.
Thank you. Final question?
Final question.
And this is just a clarification question, because if you could return to page 2 on the bill on line 24,
yes.
I think you referred to fentanyl as a Schedule 1A falls under Schedule 1A. But here I'm looking at it, and it says for Schedule IVA, controlled substances. Mm. What's the difference there?
I appreciate that. What it's saying is the person knowingly delivers or controls a substance under Alaska Statute 1171-110, and then it's a through 030 or an 1171-040 Schedule 1A for Schedule 4A. So fentanyl is found in Schedule 1, which is actually then criminalized, the distribution under Alaska Statute 1171-020. So you see that's within the string site, so that's where it's included. The reason that 4A is expressly called out is because if you go to the statute 1171-040, there are multiple subsections within that, and there is the criminalization of both the delivery of 4A and 5A drugs. But what this is saying is the penalty for homicide would only apply to Schedule 4A and not 5A. And the rationale for that is the schedules, the very top schedule, is the most potent, the most lethal. That's where you find fentanyl and heroin and things of that nature. And as you go down in the numbers of the schedules, they become less and less serious. And so this included 4A, but did not include 5A. And that's what that particular language in the bill talks about. And that's the way it's written in manslaughter currently. We did not change that policy call. We simply move it from one place to another. It's the exact same language.
So final follow-up. So if I heard you correctly, mm-hmm. and again, sorry for my lack of understanding here, the reference to Schedule 1 is found in the parentheses A, parentheses 1. That's the reference to Schedule 1, but no. Then no?
No, no. The string site, 1171-010, mm-hmm. is misconduct involving controlled substance in the first degree.
Okay.
Alaska Statute 1171-021, which you note falls between 010 and 030, right? 21's in the middle of 10 and 30. 21 is the one that deals with the distribution of fentanyl. So it's within that string site that you get to the connection for fentanyl.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, I have a few questions, and I'll try to be as quick as I can.
Take your time. I think this is a complicated, in some respects, bill. I mean, for folks who haven't gone to law school, I think there's a lot to chew on here, and so I think we need to definitely get a comfort level on this. So ask away.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for your patience. And I know that Representative Colom has already spoken to not mentioning the word fentanyl. I keep having trouble getting my head wrapped around this because I think of fentanyl as being so much more lethal than a couple of the others listed here, oxycodone for one in particular, mm-hmm. and even heroin. But I know that when we mix fentanyl with something else, it becomes hyper lethal, and I guess I understand you're now sharing with me something new, that is there are other things that are very lethal that we're not aware of, but as far as I know, and I haven't seen all the data around this, that most of the deaths that we're concerned about are related to fentanyl. Is that correct? Is that the problem we're trying to solve through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Glavin, the report that talks about the increase in the overdose deaths says that opioids and heroin both have significant increases. It goes through and it lists a bunch of those drugs that are all found in Schedule 1. If you look on page 5, I think I said it was page 4 earlier, it's page 5, there is a graph. And the blue line represents total drug overdose deaths. And then you have narcotics, and then you have psychotropics.
Thank you. Okay, I can see that. Yes, okay. Thank you. I can see that that's a step down, and it's certainly not the what we've been hearing about so much, but it's certainly there and present and a concern. The next question I have is I actually found this quite informative. Thank you very much. This is from the Alaska Department of Health. And I'm very disturbed about this problem, and I was drawn to page 8,
okay,
which describes evidence-based strategies to reduce drug overdose deaths.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably, these are things that have shown or proven to lessen the deaths specifically related to drug overdose. And in these, I think there's 5 different categories. We have prevention, harm reduction, treatment, recovery, and data collection. And there's a lot within each of those, and I appreciate that. And then what I heard from you today is that this bill today, which isn't included in any of these strategies that are evidence-based, but what I heard from you is 2 things. One, general deterrence, that if they see greater penalties, I think I heard, and the other is something related to with this extremely outrageous behavior, if they don't feel enough of an incentive, they may not change their behavior. I think those 2 things I heard. And so that led me to thinking about deterrence.
Mm-hmm.
And I did dig into that a little bit because when I read the bill, I felt like that was probably where your headspace was when it was written, or whomever wrote the bill. And so I did do a little bit of research from the U.S. Department of Justice, mm-hmm, and I'm not sure if this is something that the state of Alaska would find helpful or something that we would refer to, but I found it interesting, and it's understanding the relationship between sentencing and deterrence. And I would like you to speak to this because I want to understand why we've chosen this avenue as opposed to other ways of getting to the higher up the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do know we're doing some things along those lines, but what I have read here, and I'm going to just draw my attention to, it talks about 5 different things related to deterrence, but if I may read just briefly, Chair Foster, the one that really was interesting is it says, number 4, increasing the severity of punishment does little to deter crime. And then I highlighted laws and policies designated to deter crime by focusing mainly on increasing the severity of punishment are ineffective partly because criminals know little about the sanctions for specific crimes. Now, it may be that we have a whole plan to make sure that we are using media and other forms to help people become aware, because it does say on number 3, police deter crime by increasing the perception that criminals will be caught and punished. So I assume that may be something that you would like to address. I would be very grateful to hear more about that as I'm just kind of trying to get comfortable with what you're proposing in this bill as opposed to what I'm hearing from the presentation you gave to me from the Department of Health.
Through the chair, Representative Glavin, there's 2 different parts there. One is the report itself, and one is what DOJ says. Mm-hmm. So let me handle it in that order. Let's talk about the report itself. What you find on pages 8 and 9 mm-hmm. are prevention, harm reduction, treatment, recovery, and data collection, which is all focused on the victims.
Mm-hmm.
We believe focusing on victims and reducing demand is appropriate. And there are other efforts that the administration is undertaking to do those things as well. That's not what this bill is focused on. But that reduction for the demand is absolutely already occurring. So what those concepts talk about is all looking at the victim. We're not talking about the victim that's addicted to the drugs. What we're talking about doing is stopping the drugs from coming in, going after the people that supply it. And that is also a recognized method of trying to reduce those overdose deaths. But when the Department of Health, who focuses on the health of the individual, it makes sense that they're looking simply at the demand reduction and not trying to tackle the problem overall. So that's what that report does that I think is slightly different.
Okay. If I could ask you a question through the chair then about that. It doesn't mention how we're going to deal with victims. It just says how to reduce deaths, which I think is our overall goal. Mm-hmm. Okay. I just want to make sure that...
It is our overall goal, but mm-hmm. again, you have to read it in context. When you talk about prevention, mm-hmm. educational campaigns, interventions tailored to the community, prescription drug monitoring programs, opioid prescribing guidelines, regulating promotion and marketing of opioids, better mental health care. Do we really think better mental health care is what we're providing to the people that are distributing drugs? None of that is designed to go after the supply side. It's all designed to go after the demand side. We can do the same thing with the harm reduction. When it's talking about the availability of fentanyl test strips, naloxone access and training, that's about the person that's overdosing right there. That's not about the supply coming in that made it available to them. So, again, all of the stuff that's there when placed into context is about the demand side, not the supply side.
Thank you. And through the chair, if I could, I'm going to move over then to something else I think I heard you report. And that is that we have been able to disrupt the supply somewhat through, I think you mentioned a case of 2,000 pills and 3,000 pills. Likely, given what I'm hearing about all the numbers of what has been recently happening in Mat-Su and Anchorage, you gave quite a few numbers there. It seems like that has been fairly important. If we were able to take that off of the market, 2,000 and 3,000 pills. So I'm wondering if you could share with us a little bit about how we decided to we're thinking the good time piece, right? That taking that off the shelf as opposed to putting more investment and thought around up the food chain, if you will, as you said, dealing with those folks who are bringing the pills into Alaska and into rural Alaska in particular. How did you make the decision to move in this direction as opposed to investments in supply chain issues in this way? In other words, getting up the food chain by making sure that we have more officers in place who are doing the investigative work that's necessary to find these stashes or these people who are bringing in the pills.
Through the chair to Representative Glavin, we've done that as well. The state is a recipient of federal dollars under a program called the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. I happen to sit on that board that supervises that money coming in, which increases a number of available officers and the actions that can be taken to attack interdiction. So when I talk about this is one component, there are multiple things that the administration is working on to attack the problem. This is one piece. That interdiction is another piece. The demand side is another piece. All of those things come together and are combined to do those things. But I want to go back to the question you asked me earlier, which was about the DOJ. Because what the DOJ article that you're reading is about how you deal with deterrence generally for crime. And I agree with what the DOJ says generally for deterrence in crime, but that doesn't look specifically at how you address individuals that are engaged in the conduct for pecuniary gain. Drug dealers are doing it not because they're just flying off the handle and they're upset with somebody. It's not a domestic violence situation. It's not a sexual assault situation. It's not a theft. It's a business proposition to make money. They are thinking rationally and logically, and there is deterrence that's associated with that. And I don't think the DOJ has said differently, because if you were to look at the DOJ's actions on all of these, they would be doing the same things that we are, trying to go after those folks that are on the supply side.
Hello?
Thank you so much. So I appreciate that. I wonder, Mr. Skidmore, if you would give us any data around that to help us appreciate what we know about deterrence working then. Because I'm struggling because I'm getting disinformation. So if you have other information that helps with this understanding, I am looking forward to it. I certainly don't want to make life easier, mind you, for folks who commit these atrocious crimes. At the same time, I also want to look at a policy decision that is getting us to most efficiently the ultimate result that we want. Fewer deaths, of course, fewer people in prison. unless they've committed the crime in which we want them there. But the question is whether or not when we know they're going to eventually reenter, what is the right lever to pull to make sure we get to our goal? And that leads me to my last question. Thank you. I'm hoping that we might also visit a little bit more about expenses. In looking at the fiscal bills, I saw very little here. And if we are changing up our formula, so to speak, mm-hmm. where we're going to have Alaskans in prison substantially longer, I've heard that, oh, well, there's open beds, so it'll work. My concern is that an open bed in and of itself doesn't necessarily mean that we've got everything else covered, whether it's the lights, the food, the water, the everything else that expenses that individuals who are there for years and years would be using up. And I just want to make sure that we're honest with the full amount that this may cost the state in making these changes, just so that we can be aware and ready for that, please. Thank you.
And if I could just very quickly note some of the other folks that have been available for questions. We do have April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections, and then while I'm on that, I'll just mention we also have Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law, Michael Matthews, Research Analysis, Department of Public Safety, and Nancy Mead, General Counsel, Alaska Court System. So with that, Mr. Skidmore.
Thank you. Through the chair, if you're asking questions about fiscal notes that come from the Department of Corrections, I'm going to have to direct that to the Department of Corrections to describe their fiscal note to you and answer those specific questions that you may have.
If that would be wonderful whenever that's possible, Chair, but I also, the one last thing I do want to have you help me with, Mr. Skidmore, is the term that you used was that I'm not familiar with is prosecutorial discretion. I presume that we want to have laws written as much as possible that would have more of the decisions made within the law than to allow for discretion in general, but I may be wrong in that area, and I'd like to learn more if I could about that.
Through the chair to Representative Glavin, the criminal justice system is replete with discretion. Discretion occurs at the officer level when they're investigating cases and whether or not they're going to refer a case to the prosecutor's office. The prosecutors exercise discretion in terms of the charges that they bring, how they might resolve a case, what sentences they might seek at the end of it. You're going to find discretion in the courts in terms of the sentences that they would impose when they then are going to say this is the sanction for somebody for having broken the law. You're going to find discretion on the part of probation and parole officers when they are then supervising someone and evaluating the conduct that they've made and whether or not there should be a petition to file a petition to revoke probation or parole. So there's discretion that's actually built into the system throughout. It's a fundamental building block of the way that our system does operate. I recognize what you were describing, that you want to craft laws that carefully try and get at the conduct you're looking for, and you don't want that law to be overbroad. I absolutely agree with that. But that doesn't change the fact that there is some discretion, and that discretion is there because you all cannot possibly try and write laws that cover each individual case. The difference in the legal world, if you talk about civil law, you'll hear people talk about how complicated the law is because there's lots and lots of laws that deal with all the different issues you have to deal with. In the criminal law, it's much straightforward. The laws are fairly straightforward. There are fewer in number. But what complicates criminal law is the fact patterns. Fact patterns are infinite, and you can change by just small details. You all could not possibly legislate for individual fact patterns. In fact, it will take this bill, perhaps this year, perhaps next year, to get all the way through. If you had to do that for every fact pattern, no one would get anywhere with it because you all wouldn't have the time to try and analyze all those things. So that discretion is built in, and the way the system is designed is that that discretion is provided throughout all those individuals that I described in terms of what should be happening in certain circumstances. Whether or not that friend who provided the pill to their other friend on a camping trip or whatever else,
Does that even get to our office? I have no idea. I don't know who it is that reports that particular crime from occurring. I have no idea who the officer is that investigates that says, yep, this is something that's worthy of my time to spend it on. I need to give it to the DA. And then I don't know who the DA is that says, yeah, that person really did something wrong when I've got all these other murders and sexual assaults and other things that I have to deal with. I don't know who then says, that's what I'm going to prioritize. All of that is discretion, and that's baked into the system at all levels.
Great. And we will be taking a deeper dive into the fiscal notes down the road. But if April Wilkerson, if you're prepared to make some comments on the Department of Corrections fiscal notes, you're welcome to come up, put yourself on the record, and address the fiscal note for corrections.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Department of Corrections. Through the chair to Representative Galvin, the fiscal note that we put forward for the Department of Corrections is a zero fiscal note. Primarily, it's based on the current population. The department's budget is built and funded based on our 13 operating institutions and everything else that we need to be able to operate successfully. Our current population, however, is today it's at 85% capacity. So this legislation, given the analysis of the number of offenders that would be continue to be incarcerated, would not exceed our capacity. It would, in the out years, in our projections, we would exceed our capacity sooner than what we are currently projecting if this legislation passes. But that is expected to be not for 5 or so years. So based on the fiscal note right now and our current capacity, we do feel that we can absorb this population.
Great, thank you. And just for committee members, that fiscal note is OMB component number 1381, which is at the very back of the seven fiscal notes that we have here. So with that, we'll go, I've got Representative Stapp and Josephson, but was your comment on this, or let's go to Representative Stapp, maybe. Representative
Stapp. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I have several different aspects of questions. I'll finish with corrections, I guess, is the first one. So through the chair, if you wouldn't mind, Co-Chair Foster, sorry, didn't mean to catch you there leaving the table. So I just for clarification's sake, due to the nature of the revocation of good time, especially for Schedule 1, 2, 3, and 4s, I do not see how it is possible to have a zero fiscal note. For the reason being that those people would normally be having good time. If good time is revoked, they will be in jail longer. Is that a fair assessment?
Through the chair, April Wilkerson again. Representative Stapp, that is correct. However, the bulk of the individuals that are incarcerated under a drug offense are under a mixed five. So the number of individuals that are currently incarcerated that are expected, that are calculated out, it would increase our population less than 100 per day. And based on our current population, we can absorb that.
Okay. Second question, Co-Chair. So kind of shifting gears here just to Mr. Skidmore, just quick clarification in statutory definition. What is the definitions between distribute and delivery? What is the difference in terms of drugs?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, give me just one moment, and I'm going to pull up the definitions, and I will tell you. Here we are. The definitions for the drug offenses are found in Alaska Statute 1171-900. Delivery or deliver means actual, constructive, or attempted transfer from one person to another of a controlled substance, whether or not there is an agency relationship. And then you wanted me to compare that to distribute, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Distribute is also found in that same statute, and it means to deliver other than by administering or dispensing a controlled substance, whether or not there is any money or other item of value exchanged. It includes sale, gift, or exchange, and distributor means a person who distributes. So I think the distinction that the statute's making that definition is they're talking about distribute sort of at a higher economic standpoint. And remember, these definitions also apply to pharmaceutical companies who can distribute things, whereas delivery, I think, is more on a smaller scale is the way I would define it.
Yeah, follow-up, Co-Chair. Yeah, so the reason I kind of asked that question is because my understanding is typically the way these things works is you have different types of levels of the organization, and the intent of the bill is basically to ultimately go after kind of the people who are actually distributing the fentanyl in the state, right, between the nature of the distinction. So on that amount, I am concerned with the amendment that was made in judiciary because the issue to me clearly stems around fentanyl, meth, oxycodone, that types of things, but the amendment changes or includes all schedules 1, 2, 3, and 4. So schedule 4, we're talking Valium and Xanax, and my question is, I guess twofold regarding that for these class 4 drugs and Valium and Xanax, are we revoking good time for those as well as could they in theory be charged in the event that an individual had maybe two different distributors they found who died, they had fentanyl and they had Xanax in their system from two different people? I mean, has that actually worked legally? Does that make sense?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I apologize, there are a couple things that I was confused about, and I want to try and unpack them to make sure I get to your answer. The provision about good time is not something that was added by the Judiciary Committee. And then you were talking about deaths at another point, and the good time isn't related to the deaths. So help me,
I'll clarify,
if you can rephrase it. I want to make sure I answer your question.
So a clarification, Kutcher, thank you. So the good time is in the bill initially, but the schedules were added by amendment, class 1, 2, 3, and 4. Correct. Class 4 would be Xanax, Valium, benzodiazepines, etc., by the handout here. So it's page 3, section 7, or line 7 of the bill. Delivers any amount of Schedule 1A, 2A, 3A, or 4A. Controlled substance to the person who is A, B, or C. But it amends the statute in the subsection. So I'm curious if an individual who distributes, say, a Xanax to somebody, and the person doesn't know that a Xanax is a controlled substance, are they not going to have any good time when they're charged?
Forgive me. I want to make sure that I'm looking at the right place. The language that discusses good time is found on page 5 of the bill in section 5, and it uses a string cite to refer to the different crimes that it's impacting. But the language that you're talking about, deliver any amount of a Schedule 1, 2, 3, or 4A controlled substance, was a judiciary amendment. That's in Section 2, found on page 3 of the bill, and that's talking about delivering the drugs to the person that's mentally incapable, incapacitated, or unaware. So are you asking me about the provision for the mentally incapable, incapacitated, and unaware?
Yeah, I'll clarify again, Co-Chair, if that's all right. So just to slow it down here, the good time amends the statute, 1171010. The amendment that was made in judiciary amends the same statute to add class 1, 2, 3, and 4 controlled substances to... Correct. The mentally incapacitated, and finally, the last section is, quote, unaware that a controlled substance is being delivered, right?
Okay. So, through the chair to Representative Stapp, Section 2 that's amending Alaska Statute 1171010, and the amendment is actually found on page 3, lines 7 through 11, is amending the delivery of a schedule. It is amending misconduct involving controlled substance in the first degree, which is an unclassified felony,
and it adds this new conduct. This is about providing drugs to the person who was not requesting them. But that's nothing to do with good time. Good time is found in a different section, Section 5 of the bill, found on pages 4 and 5, specifically page 5, lines 8 through 10, are the lines that address the addition of the limitation on good time. And so if you're asking me about good time, the string cite that's there says you're limiting good time for all of that type of distribution, and that's the area where I've said there are certainly policy calls that can be made there. If you're asking me about what's found back on page 3 in a different section of the bill that's talking about the person that's being given drugs that they didn't really want, then that policy is about, do you really care that someone's being given a Xanax when they didn't ask for a Xanax? Because it's about giving somebody a drug that they didn't actually want versus the good time provisions. So those are the two different things, and those are two very different policy discussions.
All right, thanks. And I think I have just one last clarification, Co-Chair, and then I am done. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Mr. Skidmore. So regarding deterrence, right, so you referenced Nebraska basically having a high statute. I think you said that they have basically a drug homicide provision, and a result of that drug homicide provision is you have the lowest rate of fentanyl, basically deaths. Is that a fair assessment, you think?
What I indicated was I had been asked a question by Representative Hannon about which state had the lowest overdose deaths. That's found from the CDC, which is Nebraska. And then I was looking at the other states that have drug homicide provisions. I'm sorry, I'm staring at a map on my... I appreciate you asking that question. I was incorrect. Nebraska is not the state that is colored, so they do not have a drug homicide provision. I apologize, Representative Hannah. I had that inaccurate. I read that map wrong. But what was your question, Representative?
So I'm just curious on a follow-up, just to kind of clarify for the record. So I think that deterrence is a pretty good indication, like high penalties basically deter the type of drug delivery and trafficking activity. I think that's always been my experience. I think all over the world you will find that countries with the absolute harshest drug trafficking laws don't have a fentanyl problem. The example I would cite is Singapore. So thank you.
We've got Representative Representative Josephson and then Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Chairman, is Mr. Wood still available?
Mr. Wood, are you there?
Yes, I am still here. Okay. This is Sid Wood from DOC.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair for Mr. Wood, Representative Colomb asked a question, and I'd like to follow up on it. It's the idea of people getting treatment, presumably for drug addiction, in custody. Is that ever a condition of good time?
Through the chair, it is not a condition of good time. However, let me back up. They will get their good time regardless of a condition placed upon their sentence by the court that they participate in treatment. If they fail to participate in treatment, they may be subject to an anticipatory parole or probation revocation, which would have the same effect of losing good time, meaning they'd stay in jail when otherwise they would have been released as a product of receiving one-third statutory good time off their sentence. So it can, in an indirect way, affect their good time, but they will still receive all of the good time that their sentence earns up front.
And then for Mr. Skidmore, I just want to make sure on these. One thing that divided the Judiciary Committee for sure was this issue of upgrading the giving illegally, which is true now, of something like an oxycodone to someone familiar to one from under this special circumstance. And am I right that the impact of the bill is to have a sort of a double whammy in that we've increased the prison time plus stripped away the good time? I just want to make sure that that's true.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, the way the bill is currently drafted, you are correct. You would increase the penalty for distribution of Schedule I drugs, and then there would not be the availability of good time as well. That's correct.
Okay. And then I have a couple, and this is just sort of the way my mind works, but a couple of things gnawing at me that I'm just curious about that I've seen or read about in my time here. I had a colleague here who actually sat on this committee.
Mm-hmm.
This is well known publicly, whose son distributed drugs to someone who died. And, okay. And that was a federal case. Can you tell us where the federal jurisdiction begins and ends so we know? That would just help me contextually. Because I recall her son, a former colleague of this chamber, going to jail in a federal homicide related to drugs. And if you don't, this isn't meant to be a quiz, so if you don't know, I understand.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't work for the Department of Justice, so I'm not intimately familiar with the federal law, but I can give you a general description. The federal authorities and federal law applies to conduct that involves interstate activity. And drugs, crossing state lines, qualifies as interstate activity. And so when you have an individual that is killed in relation to interstate activity, then the feds would have jurisdiction. If that individual was killed in the state of Alaska, you would have a scenario in which both the federal government would have federal jurisdiction and the state government would have state jurisdiction. And because they are two different sovereigns, they could both prosecute the same individual for the exact same conduct. Again, this is one of those areas where we talk about discretion. You rarely see that occur, because the state government and the federal government, between our office and the U.S. Attorney's Office, collaborate and talk to ensure that we don't double up on resources in those types of circumstances. There are actually policies that exist within the Department of Justice that indicate that they should not be prosecuting federally those crimes in which have already been addressed at the state system. But sometimes there are differences, nuances in the laws, and somebody thinks, oh, that's the same thing, but we will get together and discuss them, and there'll be a careful analysis to say there are different societal interests, there is some rationale that allows that to occur, so you can end up with both. But the fundamental question that you're asking about their jurisdiction, their laws require a nexus to interstate conduct or commerce.
And then my last question, thank you, Mr. Chairman, relates to a bill that I actually changed my vote on a request for reconsideration on the floor. Mm-hmm. It was a bill from Representative Pruitt, who I think at the time was majority leader or minority leader.
Mm-hmm.
But it, my memory of it is it said, effectively, if you deliver a drug to someone, say a friend,
yes,
they collapse and have an episode and their life is threatened, and you call the paramedics, it acted as sort of a something more than a mitigator. It was almost like a get out of jail free card.
I think it was a safe harbor provision that prevented the ability to charge them. I'd have to find the exact statute, but I do remember the bill of which you're speaking. I'd need to look at the statute to make sure I gave you the elements correctly, but go ahead.
Follow up. If I might, the reason I'm asking about this is it would help provide some context to the overall, if I recalled, and it may be that your colleague might remember this as well, but we can talk about it later, or I just remember there was the chamber down on the floor was receptive to Representative Pruitt's bill. Very receptive, as I recall. And it help.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I believe the statute you're looking for is Alaska Statute 1171.311, restriction on prosecution for certain persons in connections with a drug overdose. A person may not be prosecuted for a violation of Alaska Statute 1171-040, 050, or 060 if that person in good faith, and then it goes through and describes the sorts of things that they would be doing. That bill or that statute does not include the conduct for misconduct involving controlled substances in the first, second, or third degree. 040 is that fourth degree. And so fourth, fifth, or sixth, it does provide that barrier to prosecution, but it does not exist, at least as I'm looking at the statute now, I don't see it existing for the higher level penalties. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I'm reading in the statute book.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll get Representative Hannon and then Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Chair Foster. So Representative Staff asked some questions, and I thought I had understood it till your answers, so now I'm going to sort of re-ask his question another way. On page 3, in the amendment that you've attributed to the Judiciary Committee, so lines 7 through 11 that is referencing not just Schedule 1A, but 2A, 3A, and 4A.
Yes.
Incapacitated, mentally incapable of delivering. So I'm going to go to the 4A. You've given a valium to somebody who was incapacitated.
Yes.
And then if we jump to what's covered on, you don't get any good time for it, the provision on page 5, all of those crimes are now in that provision of no good time. Is that correct? Because that...
Okay.
As I'm reading, that section 2 is 1171.30, so it falls within the string that says...
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I think I understand what you're asking me. The section 2 addresses Alaska Statute 1171.010, misconduct involving a controlled substance in the first degree. There's an amendment that applies to that. And if someone's convicted of that crime, would they then also have their good time restricted under Section 5? The answer to that is yes.
Okay. One follow-up?
Follow-up.
Okay, so the bill did not start out to deal with all these other non-deaths, non-overdose crimes, but it's been expanded to include a whole category of drug-related crimes, not resulting in death, not saying this is good behavior, but saying you also are no longer eligible for good time, and it could have been a Xanax.
To answer that question, I go back to Section 5, page 5, the lines we were just talking about, and you talk about drug distributions for 1171.010, misconduct involving controlled substance in the first, through misconduct involving controlled substance in the fourth, which is the 040. In those instances, the drugs, Xanax, whatever schedules you're referring to, 1 through 4, it is already illegal for someone to deliver those drugs to someone else, and convicted of any of those degrees, they would have their good time restricted as the bill was originally introduced. Then what happened is you add the conduct in Section 2, back on page 3, which takes conduct, which is already illegal, but raises the level of it because of another factor, i.e. the person getting the drugs didn't actually ask for it. It makes it a higher level offense, and that would still fall under the no good time provision, but the no good time provision didn't expand. You just took certain conduct and elevated that punishment elsewhere. I hope that's clarifying.
Thank you.
Okay.
You got Representative Clove.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So I'm just trying to get clarity on the times that someone's going to be convicted of murder instead of manslaughter.
Okay.
So one of my questions is, I'm no lawyer, so forgive me for not knowing, but I thought the division between manslaughter and murder in the first degree, second degree, was intention. So there was an intention to murder someone. And manslaughter was, yes, you murdered someone, but there was not an intention to do so. So if you're someone who's distributing drugs, it's not really their intentions to kill people. That's what happens. But I'm wondering how we can jump from manslaughter to murder when when I don't see that there's a lot of intention. And not in every case, but, you know, in general, that's not the intention.
Through the chair, the answer is that our homicide statutes, not all murder statutes require intention. So it is an appropriate jump. But let me lay out some of the hierarchy for you to help try to explain it. You have murder in the first degree, and that's where you find your intentional conduct. That's Alaska Statute 1141-100. And the intentional conduct being the most serious conduct, that's murder in the first degree. Murder in the second degree, as it exists right now in law, has several other subsections. And that's Alaska Statute 1141-110. And what that one says is that you can commit homicide if you knowingly engage in conduct that results in the death of another person under circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference to the value of human life. Let me give you an example. That's a lot of words. So the example that's frequently used is you have somebody that has a firearm and they are shooting into a tent and there's someone inside the tent. Are they intending to kill that person? They may not be intending to. It may not be their conscious objective. That's the definition of intent. It may not be their conscious objective to kill them. But firing into that tent is knowingly engaging in conduct that's extremely indifferent to the value of human life because there's a good chance you are going to kill somebody there. Another subsection of murder in the second degree also talks about felony murder. And felony murder occurs where someone is committing a felony, and in the course of committing the felony, another person is killed. Not intentionally, just that another person is killed. That's also murder in the second degree. And then there's a subsection 4 and a subsection 5 and the subsection, these other subsections of murder in the second degree also don't involve the intent. So when we talk about moving it to murder in the second degree, that's an appropriate place to put it. If we had moved it to murder in the first degree, where you find that intentional conduct, that's where your criticism would make more sense.
Okay.
Okay.
One follow-up?
Follow-up.
So when you, I guess I was looking at the bill trying to figure out, I was looking at line 22 on page 2, talking about Schedule 4A controlled substances and a person
yes.
dies as
yes.
a direct result of ingestion, but I thought, so 4A, I thought fentanyl was 5A. Is it 4, like in the chart, 4A has Xanax in it. So
if I can refer to the chart to try and help you out,
okay,
ma'am.
Thank you. It,
through the chair, if you look at the one that says drug classifications, and you'll find Schedule 1A at the top,
right.
And 1A is where you find fentanyl listed off to the right. It's a Schedule 1A. And then 2A has your psychedelics or hallucinogens, like peyote, magic mushrooms, PCP, those sorts of things. It also includes stimulants like methamphetamine and Adderall or amphetamines, barbiturates and cocaine. 3A then comes down, and that's your stimulants, depressants, or other anesthetics, appetite suppressants, sedatives that are hypnotics. And then you go down to your 4A, which are your benzodiazepines, I hope I'm saying that word correctly, and ketamine. So you have other drugs like that, but that's the way it sort of moves down. But fentanyl is found at the very top, Schedule 1A.
Okay. So through the chair, if it's okay. So why would this just say 4A controlled substances? Does it mean 1 to 4?
So that particular statute, let's unpack the language there, and I'm looking on line 23 of page 2. You start with 1171-010, which is the crime of misconduct involving controlled substance in the first degree. And then you have the dash followed by 1171-030, which is misconduct involving controlled substance in the third degree. That string citation covers three different crimes, misconduct involving controlled substance in the first, the second, and the third. Or it can include this other statute, 1171-040, subsection A1. That's misconduct involving controlled substance in the fourth degree. Misconduct involving controlled substance in the fourth degree has multiple subsections. But most importantly, within that, the distribution of schedules 4A and 5A are criminalized in the same subsection. And the distinction that this language makes is that it is saying if someone takes a Schedule 4A drug and dies, then the person who provided it to them can be held accountable for the death. But because it does expressly does not say anything about 5A. If they took a 5A drug and died, they would not be held accountable for their deaths. And if you look at 5A drugs, there are things like Suboxone or steroids, anabolic steroids, the type of drugs that you typically don't associate somebody taking those and overdosing from them. So you typically are not going to have overdose deaths associated with it. But that's the policy call that's made in that language there, and that's not a policy call that we made at this time. That's the policy call that was made back in 2006 when the statute was first enacted. Does that help clarify?
Yeah, that does. Just one short comment. So through the chair, so I want to be sure that we all know, mm-hmm. if this passes, mm-hmm. that we're charging murder mm-hmm. for someone giving someone else a Valium or Xanax. That's why, or whatever this is, that's why I'm sorry for all the questions, but to me, taking someone's rights away and putting them in jail for a long time, and I want to be sure I know what I'm doing here with that. So thank you for being patient and trying to explain that. But that's a pretty severe sentence. I understand where the administration's coming from and what they're trying to do, but I'm just trying to make sure we know for sure what we're looking at. So thank you for your time, and thank you, Chair, for the patience.
Absolutely. And the thing to remember is the distribution of that drug is not the key. The key is that the person died. They have to have died from this. Great.
Thank you. And we'll go to our last question for the day, and it'll be time for us to wrap up. And there's a lot to chew on here, so we'll definitely come back to this. But with that, Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. And I don't know if I have a question. There was lots of good conversation here today. But if I have 91 communities in my district, two of the most important issues in my district are we have no salmon in the Yukon, and drugs are rampant in our villages. And as far as I'm concerned, this bill doesn't touch. This doesn't do enough. I would be way more strict, and I think we had that conversation. This doesn't do enough. We have drugs ruining people, ruining families. I had a young lady in my office yesterday said meth use on Saturday is normalized now. Normalized. And everybody that I talk to in my village is saying, we want the drug dealers stopped. We want them put away. This doesn't go far enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Any closing comments for the day, Mr. Skidmore? I think, again, the plan will be we'll come back to this. We still need to take a deep dive into the fiscal notes. I think there's probably more policy considerations, and there might be more questions. And so we definitely want folks to kind of take this introduction and think about things. But with that, just want to give you a final closing statement.
I appreciate that, Chair. The bill is designed to go after the supply of the drugs coming into the state that are causing the deaths, and it's impacting folks all across the state. If you look at the percentages, you find that it's literally all over the state. But when you read the report, it also tells you that this is a crime and the overdose deaths that are disproportionately impacting Native Alaskans in rural communities. So I appreciate the comments that we just heard from Representative Kronk, because what he's hearing from his constituents is borne out in the report of the data of where the impacts are seen most pervasively. And so that is something that's worthwhile to look at and to consider. I recognize there's a lot of details and nuances in the bill. I've tried to come around and meet with all of the folks here. I'm happy to answer questions on the record. If you all have other questions off the record or things that you want to dive into, I want to continue to extend my department, either myself or Ms. Schroeder. Please contact us if you have questions. We're happy to talk with you about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So with that, our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is tomorrow, 1:30, Friday, April 14th. And at that meeting, we'll hear two bills. That's HB 93, which is lumber grading, and HB 26, that's renaming Council for Native Languages. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we will be adjourned at 3:22 p.m. Thank you.